Welcome back to Truncated Thoughts, presented by Prescouter, where we have short discussions on big ideas in healthcare. I'm Jeremy Schmier, and with me is Dr. Ryan LaRanger. A trend we've been following is the idea of lab on a chip, right? Which basically allows multiple functions to occur on a single chip for more efficient laboratory analysis of systems, chemicals, and more. The early applications of lab on a chip were seen in things like semiconductors, pressure sensors, and fluid handling devices. What we've been seeing in recent years, however, is lab on a chip being used to mimic various systems in the body, such as the cardiovascular system, allowing for greater analysis, diagnostics, and drug discovery. So Ryan, help us understand why lab on a chip is important, why it can be so useful.
So at a high level, labs on a chip basically allow you to engage in discovery or screening work for things that are more complicated than just cell death. For instance, you can look at functions, biomarkers that might be more complicated than the kind of thing you can observe in classical tissue culture. One of my favorite examples of this is, for instance, cardiotoxicity. Cardiotoxicity is a huge problem in, let's say, oncological or chemotherapeutic drugs. And it's something that's very difficult to capture unless you have functioning or pseudo-functioning cardiac tissue on which you can test. Normally, that's something that only comes up in animal models. With a lab on a chip, it allows you to, before you start working in an animal model, evaluate some of those complicated biological processes. There are a number of other things it can do also. It's one of my favorite topics, but that's a general idea. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so it sounds like it's a way to test without necessarily the same risk that would come with doing it within the actual ecosystem of someone's body. It's something that you're doing it outside. Yeah, help me unpack this.
Sure. To make a drug, and this data might actually be old, it's like 10 years and $1 billion to develop a drug. Part of the reason why this cost exists is because the farther along you go in the development pipeline for a given compound, the more expensive failure is, right? So if you have a compound that fails in, say, preclinical studies, that hasn't cost you or your organization a lot of money, right? If a drug is in phase one trials, you've had to, you know, recruit all of those patients, you've had to deliver all those drugs, you've had to recruit all those doctors, that's kind of expensive. If you have a phase three failure, you have a huge problem. One of the issues is that many of these more complicated physiological toxicity problems, like cardiotoxicity, lung toxicity, these are things which often don't get caught until very late in the drug development process, because animal models are wonderful. Sometimes they don't catch these because there are significant differences between, say, mouse hearts and human hearts, right? Mouse lungs and human lungs, there are just these huge differences. And so what that means is that if you're looking for these kinds of rare events, you might not capture them until very late in drug discovery when that failure state becomes ridiculously expensive. A lab on a chip basically allows you to simulate some of those very expensive failure states very early in a drug development process. Does that help a little bit?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. It's sort of like a trial run in some ways. It's like the very early clinical trials before it becomes real. You mentioned it could apply to things like lungs or other organs, maybe kidneys. I mean, are there organs that are more or less ripe for lab on a chip? And what challenges exist from organ to organ?
That's a great question. I like that a lot. So if you're searching for this on Google or anywhere else, there's a sort of a subset of lab on a chip called body on a chip, where people are trying to simulate basically as many organs as possible on a small microfluidic device that allows for circulation of media, which is basically pretending to be blood in this instance, across all of these simulated organs. Now, there are some which are easier Liver is somewhat easier. Kidney is somewhat easier. Somewhat. Huge. All of these are challenging. It's just some are more so because so if you have, say, liver, kidney, as long as you can get the basic mechanical elements of the media that it's growing on correct, you'll do okay. There are some organs, for instance, lung and heart, which require rhythmic mechanical stimuli to induce the differentiation that produces cells, which can then sort of simulate that function. There are beautiful studies that have come out of a few labs, for instance, that stimulate alveoli production through a simulating breathing with very clever use of pressure differentials. So you'll have a structure and it will bend, it'll contract and compress in response to changes in pressure, and that creates a change in alveoli. For hearts, and this is my favorite, they can condition induced pluripotent stem cells or other cell types, we'll talk about that in a second, to contract rhythmically over and over again until they become differentiated cardiac muscle tissue through rhythmic electronic stimulation in order to basically condition this little piece of muscle until it kind of is like a heart.
Wow. So you're simulating and building something to function as though it were a heart so you can conduct these various tests and develop drugs to address these different issues that might come from it. I mean, who's doing this? How is this even possible? It sounds very nascent and sort of a young innovation.
This is startups and academic labs. If I were to list them, I would miss some of the best ones. I feel terrible about that. But it's a number of very impressive labs that are working on this. There are some startups that are doing it, but again, this is in very early stages. And the technology is sort of coming in pieces. If we were to sort of very briefly talk about the problems facing the space and sort of where people are innovating right now, some of it is in the mechanics. How do you make a microfluidic system, which is scalable, works at that speed, works at that size, and doesn't cost a ton of money, right? Because you're going to need a bunch of these. Some of it is a matter of what are the right cells? Are they induced pluripotent stem cells? Can you make them individual for each patient? Theoretically, but there are some challenges there. And we talked about our induced pluripotent stem cells a little bit before. And part of it is a matter of how do you get the cells in the right place? How do you engineer it? And another challenge, and this is actually one of my favorites, is how do you get data out of the system? What are the sensors that you're using? Are they mechanical? Are they sensors that are triggered by epitope binding? There are a couple of different ways to do it, and these are all things that can be explored, but I don't think for this episode of this podcast.
Yeah, I think you just gave us a very good prelude to a future episode, and you know, we should have our next episode focus on nanotech, tissue engineering, microfluidics, some of these other ideas, which seem to be good tree branches of this topic. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we tie off for today?
So the only thing I would say is many of the things that we were talking about in terms of toxicity screening, part of what makes them attractive for lab on a chip innovation is that once these technologies get going, it allows you to test a large number of potential drugs. So like very early in the drug development cycle, you might be able to say, here are 1,000 candidates. Let me see if any of them are a risk for toxicity, as well as running your other tests for potential efficacy. If you can get to that degree of scalability, it might significantly decrease your risk for developing the wrong compound, which causes you an issue in a phase 3 trial.
Let me ask you a more basic question from what you just said. It sounds like if you can test a lot of different drugs on the same simulated heart structure, wouldn't you need to have made a lot of these so that you can, because if you damage from the heart from one of these tests, if there's an adverse event, isn't that no longer a useful
Yes, 100%. I mean, so when we're talking about lab on a chip, you want it to be, that's sort of why I bring up the idea of scalability. You want it to be as small right. as possible so you can run theoretically as many compounds as possible as cheaply as possible.
So they who are able to make a lot of these at scale and be able to get them, you know, have them tested for many, many drugs is the winner.
That's going to be one of the winning factors, because it's, if you don't have scale, many of the many components of the value proposition for lab on a chip break down. If it's as expensive right. as a, to run, if it's more expensive to run a lab on a chip experiment than to run a mouse study, it will be hard for me to convince whoever it is I'm reporting to that we should do the lab on a chip instead of the mouse study. Once that system becomes more scalable, it becomes more valuable.
All right. Sounds like this is your save the mouse campaign as well.
No, you'll still need mouse studies. This is just an addition, I think.
I'm just kidding. So let's leave it there for today. We hope everyone enjoyed the conversation. If you're not a subscriber, find us on Apple, Spotify, and Stitcher. And in our next episode, we're going to dive a little bit deeper into nanotech and some of the types of ideas we discussed today. But until then, thanks for listening.